Iku Iluna, please rise. Auhea oko o ikoka aha, inahe kuleana imua okea aha, o okolo kolo kiike hanohano, o kamoko aina o Hawaii. Inaui mai, imaleo mai, ilohe ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh, give your attention and you shall be heard. Inoho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-23-11, In Re Tax Appeal of Cole. Arguing for the petitioner, Skylar E. Cole and Marilyn J. Cole, Ian Luthringer. Arguing for the respondent, City and County of Honolulu, Daniel Gluck. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, as well as on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our substitute judges, justices, Judge Jeanette Castagnetti and Judge James Ashford. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed? All right. We've allocated 30 minutes for argument on each side. Mr. Luthringer, you'll have 20 minutes, and we'll give you a warning light at that point with 10 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Gluck, you have 30 minutes, and we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Mr. Luthringer, please proceed.
May it please the court. As you're already aware, my name is Ian Luthringer. I'm an attorney with Settlemyer Law, counsel for Skylar and Marilyn Cole, the lead appellants in this case. We are here today to ensure a just administration of the Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure. Namely, that individuals receive fair notice of the triggers to the commencement of the 30-day period for filing an appeal under Rule 4A3. The issue before this court is whether the plain language of Rule 4A3 includes an automatic trigger that divests the court of its inherent authority to enter an order and also triggers the commencement of the time for filing an appeal. This court should rule in favor of the appellants and determine that there is no such automatic trigger for two reasons. First, the plain language of Rule 4A3 does not identify an automatic trigger to the commencement of the time for filing an appeal. If there is any such trigger, it dwells sub silentio and therefore cannot possibly provide fair notice to individuals of its existence. Second, the plain language of the rule supports that we don't even require an automatic trigger to the commencement of time for appeal because the trial court retains its jurisdiction to enter an order if the clerk fails to file a clerk's notice within 5 days after the judge does not enter an order. As to the first reason, the plain language of Rule 4A3 identifies only two possible triggers to the commencement of the time for appeal. One, the filing of an order, and the second, the filing of a clerk's notice. Clause one of the rule establishes an order as the default trigger to the commencement of the time for appeal. We know this because clause one does not reference the clerk's notice. Clauses 2, 3, and 4 collectively establish an exception whereby the clerk's notice may serve as an alternate trigger to the commencement for the time for appeal.
Mr. Luthringer, you talked about only two paths to appeal. The rule seems to be structured on the premise that either the court is going to act or the clerk is going to act, but there's a third possibility, as the ICA pointed out in the Sanchez case, which is that there'll be no action. And why does it necessarily follow if there is no action that there is no time for appeal? Because in this case, 5 years went by.
Yes, Your Honor. If there is no action by the court or the clerk, we would defer again to clause one of the rule that provides the default rule. The only way that the clerk is divested of its authority is via the clerk filing a notice. So in that case, whether 1 year, 5 years, 10 years goes by, it's not on the parties because they are not mandated by the rule to act.
Counsel, I have a more fundamental question here. Why are we talking about Rule 4? Because isn't this appeal governed by Hawaii Revised Statute Section 232-19? Rule 4 and the extension period there applies to civil appeals pursuant to 641-1. I think it's subsection C. And it says that, and 641-1 says appeals from civil types of cases shall be pursuant to court rule. But it talks about civil cases and it talks about land court, but it does not include tax appeal court. And it appears to me that this appeal is strictly governed by HRS 232-19, which requires that the notice of appeal be filed within 30 days of the judgment. The language now says judgment. A judgment is required. I don't understand why we're talking about Rule 4, because it appears to me that Rule 4 does not even apply here.
Yes, Your Honor. It is acknowledged that Rule 232-19 does govern tax appeals. It does, however, state in that rule that there is a right to appeal to the Intermediate Court of Appeals in that rule. So,
what do you mean by the rule?
Oh, in the statute, in 232-19.
So you're saying that that right would extend forever then?
No, that right allows for the right to appeal, which puts it to the Intermediary Court of Appeal, which puts it under the purview of the rules of the Intermediary Court of Appeal and the appellate rules. And we're discussing extension of time because a post-judgment motion was filed. 232-19 doesn't address that potentiality. So we must defer to the appellate rules to understand what happens if a post-judgment motion is filed.
So that is the basis for your argument that HRAP Rule 4 would actually apply here.
That rule,
the extension portion of that rule.
Yes, Your Honor. That Rule 4E3 would apply in this particular case.
All right. Then assuming that to be the case, then looking at the plain language of Rule 4, it only applies if there's a statute or a court rule that sets a time frame for filing a motion, including a motion for recon. So what rule are you saying applies here?
Again, Your Honor, we would refer back to 232-19, and it does provide that it needs to be filed within 30 days, but then Rule 4 supplements that by saying if a post-judgment motion is filed, then the time
it says, and if there's a court rule or a statute that sets a time limit for resolving that, it says, let's see, if a party timely files a motion, and there's all kinds of motions, so I'm going to, apply it here. If a party timely files a motion to reconsider and court or agency rules specify the time by which the motion shall be filed, then the time for filing the notice of appeal is extended for all parties until 30 days after entry of an order disposing of the motion. So my question is, if 4A3 applies, which I don't think it does, what is the court or agency rule specifying the time by which the motion for reconsideration is to be filed? What rule are you relying upon here?
The rule we would fall back on the rules of civil procedure for a motion for reconsideration, the 10-day rule.
Okay.
And those would inherently be incorporated to a tax appeal proceeding. proceeding because they're bound by the rules of civil procedure.
So you're relying on the general motion for recon rule under 60B?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
Carry on.
Thank you. So clause 2, 3, and 4 establish this exception whereby the clerk's notice may serve as a trigger to the time for filing an appeal. Nonetheless, the appellee is alleging that there is this third automatic trigger to the commencement of the appeal period. Again, this is the appellee's version of the second shooter on the grassy knoll, because there is no evidence in the rule that supports an automatic trigger. The rule speaks for itself, and the plain language of the rule demonstrates that the time for filing an appeal commences at the time either the court files the order or the clerk files the clerk's notice.
I'm going to come back to the initial question on 232-19, and you represented that the statute gives you the right to appeal to the ICA. But the language I see that I don't see a right being asserted in this statute. It says any taxpayer may appeal to the ICA subject to Chapter 602 from the decision of the Tax Appeal Court by filing a written notice of appeal within 30 days after filing of the decision. Actually, it just says decision. Okay, so then how do you distinguish Alford versus City and County of Honolulu, the 2005 opinion?
I'm sorry, Honor, not prepared for that.
That case held that this language decision means decision, and you don't need a judgment from which to appeal. And that the Cades versus Shuddy final judgment rule does not apply. The Rule 58 requirement of a final judgment under HRCP does not apply to tax appeals court.
Your Honor.
And the 30 days is triggered based on the decision.
Your Honor, again, we would rely on the fact that in following the rules of civil procedure, we timely filed pursuant to rules or prior counsel timely filed a motion for reconsideration, extending the period set forth in 239-19 by 30 days.
In Alford, we said that HRCP applies to the extent it doesn't conflict. And we said that Rule 58 basically conflicts with 232-19 that requires an appeal within 30 days of a decision.
Right. So the language I believe we're focused on in 239-19 is this concept that the parties, the taxpayers, have the right to appeal to the, or I shouldn't say the right to appeal, that they may appeal.
Within 30 days right. of the decision.
And that creates a reasonable expectation that they will be allowed to appeal. And generally, I understand that you're citing this case, but even when you're dealing with pro se litigants, which our party was when they initiated the case, a decision is going to look
like.
Were
they pro se at the tax appeal court?
They were when they filed, but then they became
right.
represented.
There was counsel and by right. the time the decision was made, right?
Yes.
You see, this statute, in my view, indicates, and 232-19 says, second paragraph, all such appeals shall be speedily disposed of, and in the hearing and disposition thereof shall be given preference over other litigation in the discretion of the court. So it seems to me that the legislature is clearly saying that tax appeals need to be promptly decided because, as you can imagine, how does the city address budgeting 5 years after a tax assessment? I mean, you know, I think there's issues that arise, right? And so therefore, it seems to me that the legislature is setting out a different standard for tax appeals by excluding it from 641-1 actions that are civil in nature.
Your Honor, at the end of the day, the matter was decided by the tax appeal court utilizing the rules of civil procedure. Our client relied on prior counsel. They relied on the language in Rule 4A. They had the fair belief that they had the right to appeal.
It was a different law firm that didn't appeal?
Yeah, and there's no language in the rule itself which would purport to let them know that a tax appeal is excluded. For all intents and purposes, the only limitations by 602 are related to jurisdictional issues of the Intermediary Court of Appeal. And there was no limitation clear in that language that would prevent Rule 4A
from applying. 641-1A says, appeals shall be allowed in civil matters from all final judgments, orders, or decrees of circuit and district courts and the land court to the ICA. They included land court, but they didn't include the tax appeals court.
Yes, Your Honor. The circuit court does fall under the purview, or I'm sorry, the tax appeal court does fall under the purview of the circuit court. And there's also language when it gets to talking about the circuit court's authority under 603-21.9, authorizing the court to enter any orders that are necessary to resolve a matter before it. It then in 232 says that the tax court should have the same powers as the circuit court. So there is some correlation and connection.
Where does it say that?
I can't remember the exact site in 232, but in 603-21.9 is where it authorizes the court to enter orders that are before it. And then again, I can't recall the exact site offhand for 232, but it identifies that the tax court of appeal will have the same powers as the circuit court does to enter orders.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Luthringer. In 232.19, it says they may appeal to the intermediate appellate court subject to Chapter 602. And then 602.11 talks about the Supreme Court's power to promulgate rules in all civil and criminal cases. So would that mean when the legislature adopted the 30-day limit that it was subject to rules of procedure that might be adopted by this court? Or would you say that tax appeal court is not a tax appeal is different from a civil appeal? That might be one answer to that.
Your Honor, I believe it follows the same process. So yes, they are both subject to the same procedural rules.
Please carry on with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the second reason for finding in favor of the appellants, namely that the third trigger is not required because the court retains its jurisdiction, the appellee, in essence, manufactured the need for a third automatic trigger.
Let me ask you, how does the court retain its jurisdiction when you have the nullity language? And the rule was amended after Sukuma. We have any orders entered thereafter shall be a nullity. It seems like that divests the court of jurisdiction after 90 days. Why doesn't it?
Your Honor, it doesn't divest the court after 90 days because the language in Clause 3 of 403 or of the Rule 4A3 is clear that the clerk shall provide the parties notice that the motion is denied, which is
a. Do you think the clerk's notice has legal effect? I mean, a notice is separate from the event itself, and it seems that a notice can be used merely to inform the parties of something that may have already happened, such as after the 90 days, it's deemed denied, and then we just give you an extra five-day cushion for 125-day period from final judgment to file your appeal. How does that clerk's notice have any legal effect?
Your Honor, in this case, that clause three states thereafter are deemed a nullity. And that thereafter is referring to provision of the clerk's notice.
Is that clear? Why is it thereafter referring to the 90 days?
The entry portion of that clause is setting up when the clerk can act. The clerk can act if the trial court doesn't file an order on the record. The clerk shall act within 5 days after 90 days. That reference to 90 days is identifying when the clerk may take action. It then says the clerk shall provide notice that, comma, the motion is denied, and that thereafter order shall be deemed a nullity. So that the second that refers it right back, the notice that motion's denied, the notice that orders thereafter shall be deemed a nullity. It's read with reference to the immediately preceding act.
Which is the notice.
Which is the provision of notice, which is the operative act in this case.
So you have sort of a fallback position. I know one position is that the court retained authority to enter the order that it did 5 years after the fact, right? That's kind of your lead position as I understand it. You have sort of a fallback position, which is even if we find that if we answer the question we were just discussing in another way, and that after 90 days the court couldn't act, nevertheless, there still needs to be a notice. Could you explain the differences? At least that's how I understood this sort of alternative argument. Am I characterizing it correctly?
Your Honor, I believe that the fallback here is that the statute itself doesn't provide fair notice of what is expected or required of the litigants. There is no reference to an automatic trigger. So if it turns out that there was this automatic sub silento denial and nullification of orders, that is not clear on the plain language of the rule. We know that because we're here having this discussion. So it's not clear. And if it wasn't clear, the appellants couldn't reasonably be held to abide by it. They didn't know it existed.
Why is it then that your letter request is simply a notice and not the court to issue an order?
Well, one, that letter, Your Honor, was sent by prior counsel. We had conferred with them. However, ultimately the decision was up to them whether to ask for an order or notice. And in essence, it's testing the law. The clerk didn't act. They didn't file the clerk's notice. What they did was turn it over to the judge, and the judge filed an order. Again,
you know, I mean, but I think, you know, your interpretation would essentially means there's no deadline. I mean, if the clerk doesn't file notice, and quite frankly, in the real world, it does seem that if the judge doesn't know, the clerk doesn't know, the clerk doesn't know, the judge doesn't know, it isn't going to be in the 90 to 95 day window that somebody's going to figure things out. So it's just going to no order, which I see it being denied. It shall be a nullity. That was an amendment. And then the clerk's notice then continues on. It's never given. It takes a party 5 years to figure things out, maybe writes a letter. But if that letter wasn't written, the court clerk didn't act, or the court didn't act, then what, 50 years later, you can come in with an appeal?
Your Honor, we're not saying that the interest of judicial efficiency isn't valuable. We're not saying that there shouldn't be a limit on the time that's allowed to run. We're simply saying that this rule, as drafted, doesn't set that time. There's nothing in it that provides fair notice that on this date, you're automatically going to have the time for appeal to run. States like California, they say the time for appeal will commence filing of a notice, entry of an order, or the passage of 180 days, the earlier of. It's very clear. The parties have noticed. They understand what's going to happen. Here, that wasn't the case.
Why was the rule amended? I mean, you know, in light of Sukuma, the Hawaii Rules of Appellate, you know, the committee got together, this court passed the rule. It just seems like, why pass the rule if we're back to sort of the Sukuma landscape?
My understanding of Sukuma, Your Honor, is that the rule was in Sukuma, they decided that the court retained the jurisdiction to enter an order because the deemed denial language only applied to a deemed denial.
Okay, and that would be the difference then. In the new rule, the court is, it's there's a nullity. The court is divested of jurisdiction. That seems to be the difference.
In the new rule, they actually stripped the provided that, the limitation on the court's authority, the deemed denial language, they removed it from Clause 1, but left Clause 1 otherwise as it is, which to me says there's no longer a limitation on Clause 1. Clause 1 now says it's 30 days after an order is entered. No provided that. But now we have Clauses 2, 3, and 4, which lay out an exception. But that exception only applies if certain conditions are satisfied. Namely, the court doesn't file an order in 90 days. The clerk does file the clerk's notice within 5. So those would be the two exceptions. And if that is not done, then the court retains jurisdiction. That's just a plain reading of the language. And under that, our clients, they would have expected one of two things, an order to be filed or the clerk's notice for the time to appeal to run. The fact that the court didn't act when it should, the fact that the clerk didn't act when he should, doesn't trigger an obligation on our client since there's nothing in the rules that say they have to act. So they shouldn't be held accountable and to suffer because the court didn't take action. We see even in Rule 16 regarding scheduling orders, there's a mandate for the court to act in 90 days or 60 days, depending on certain situations. In that rule, there's also no consequence if the court doesn't act. But we all know what happens. Eventually, the clerk, the court, or a party figures it out and they take action. Here, our client was reassured by their prior counsel that the time for appeal didn't commence because an order wasn't filed and the clerk's notice wasn't filed. And that counsel relied on the plain language of the rule. Now, we're not saying that you shouldn't put a time limit on this. We're saying in this case, there shouldn't be a time limit. If the court wanted to amend the rule to introduce an automatic third trigger or an absolute drop-dead deadline on the court's authority being revoked, the court could certainly revise the language to make it very clear, like California, you have A, B, or C, whatever occurs first, right? And then the parties have fair notice of how they need to act. So that is what we're here today about, and that's what we're trying to accomplish, the recognition that our client just needs fair notice based on a rule.
Anything further, or do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
I will reserve time for rebuttal if it's okay, well, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank Mr. you.
May it please the court. First, as to Justice McKenna's questions, I am embarrassed that I'm not familiar with 232.19. I apologize for not noticing that or briefing that. If the court would like supplemental briefing, we are certainly happy to do that. Based on Your Honor's description of the statute, I think the city's position would be that we would argue in the alternative that either Rule 4 sets a clear deadline or it does not, and then 232.19 would apply. But that's, I think, as good as I can do right now.
Well, the Chief Justice raises a good point that 232.19 specifically refers to Rule 602, which allows the promulgation of rules. So if that is the situation, then Rule 4 would apply. Now, after Sukuma, the rule was amended, but Sukuma was based on the portion of the rule that says the time for filing the notice of appeal is extended for all parties until 30 days after entry of an order disposing of the motion. That was the ruling in Sukuma. That portion of the rule was never amended.
Correct.
There's 30 days from something, because as opposing counsel argues, the whole idea is people need to have notice. Due process requires something to say, okay, here is my deadline. This is what I need to do. And the argument that the amendment that said, oh, the amendment was intended to have somebody file something so that the deadline could be triggered. Now, you, the city, just as much as the taxpayer, could have requested a Rule 23 order.
Yes.
And you didn't do so. It's not just on them. The city could have done it to say, we need a deadline for filing this.
That's correct, Your
Honor. And the argument that this is a jurisdictional issue, then what about Rule 2 of the Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure? In the interest of expediting a decision or other good cause shown, either Hawaii Appellate Court may suspend the requirements or provisions of any of these rules in a particular case in accordance on our own accord. The whole idea is to allow people to have their issues decided on the merits. And I'm having difficulty understanding why you, the city, is arguing that it is really the taxpayer's responsibility here.
Sure. Well, first, as to the jurisdictional question, the time within Rule 4 is jurisdictional. And so I don't think the court can waive it pursuant to 2.1.
Wait, jurisdictional? If it was jurisdictional, how could we waive it under Rule 2?
These are court
rules. We can waive deadlines under the court rules. This is a part of HRAP. Jurisdictional is subject matter jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction. I'm not comfortable tossing around the concept of jurisdiction when we're talking about other issues. You know, we had this problem with Schwartz versus State, where we, you know, address these issues of whether it's actually jurisdictional or whether it's a court deadline. The jurisdiction is set out by the statutes, by the legislature. So they say 30 days from the decision, but it does say, hey, it's pursuant to Rule 6, subject to Chapter 602. We promulgated these rules under Chapter 602.
Mm-hmm.
So why shouldn't the taxpayer get an appeal?
I think because this court has repeatedly held that the time limits for filing the appeal are jurisdictional. And they cannot be waived. They cannot be, cannot apply.
30 days from the entry of the order on the motion. Where's the order? It was filed in 2022.
Sure. So regarding the language of Rule 4A3, so you're correct that that language that you had quoted remains unchanged from 2016. But even if you take that language literally...
Mr. Gluck, maybe pull the mic up just a little bit.
I'm sorry. Even if you take that language literally, it's contradicted if in no other place by the fourth sentence, which talks about triggering the deadline by either entry of the order or entry of notice by the clerk.
And so neither happened.
And neither happened, Your Honor. But I think if you take a literal view of the first and fourth sentences, if those stood alone, then I would agree with you that one of those events has to occur, but they don't stand alone. And the court amended the rule to include the second and third sentences, which contemplate a limited tolling period for post-judgment motions such as this. And so I think taking the
Your position is, despite Sukuma, in which we said it has to be 30 days from entry of an order, and then we amended the rule to try to get someone to file something to trigger this, and based on the judiciary's failure to comply with its own rules, litigants should lose their right to appeal. Because this is the judiciary's failure to follow its own rules.
Mm-hmm.
And too bad for the litigants.
Yeah, and I think to that point, Your Honor, there are sometimes harsh consequences from jurisdictional rules. I mean, sometimes people miss court deadlines.
How do you define jurisdiction?
I'm sorry?
How do you define jurisdiction?
As the court's authority to rule on a case.
All right. Then are you saying that we are without authority under Rule HRAP Rule 2 to extend the deadlines if we choose to do so?
Yes, I think that's right, Your Honor.
Oh, so All right, based on what? Because Article 6 says that this court has, our courts have jurisdiction as provided by law. And we interpret that to be pursuant to the statutes. 23219 says it's 30 days, but subject to Chapter 602. We promulgated these rules per Chapter 602. We can suspend the deadlines per HRAP Rule 4. So I'm having a lot of difficulty understanding your jurisdiction argument.
No, and I understand your logic, Justice McKenna, but this court has repeatedly held that the time limits in HRAP 4 are jurisdictional and cannot be waived and cannot be extended.
And after Sakuma, what have we said?
To that point, Your Honor, the court can continue to apply the analytical framework used in
Sakuma. I'm sorry, can you speak more? I can't hear you.
Okay. Is that better?
Sorry, that's better.
Thank you. The court can continue to apply the jurisdictional framework of, the analytical framework of Sakuma. You have the canons of statutory construction, which are used to analyze the rule, and you can continue to apply those well-worn canons to this case. But stare decisis does not compel a result that jurisdiction lies here. The court can and should look fresh at the new language that was promulgated after 2016 and can and should reach a different result.
So basically your argument here is that all the, after Sakuma, the amendment, all it did was extend the deadline for filing a notice of appeal for another 5 days.
Your Honor,
because pre-Sakuma, if it was deemed denied, it had to be 30 days between the 90, after the 90 day deemed denial. Mm. And because we filed a rule that says either the court disposes of it within 90 days or the clerk files a notice and you get 30 days from that. You're saying that all this rule amendment did was extend the deadline for 5 days and it got rid of the language in Sakuma, the holding of Sakuma, which was 30 days from an order disposing of the motion, which was not changed.
Sure. So, Your Honor, the court is obviously very familiar with the difference between may and shall, and throughout Rule 4A3 uses mandatory language to talk about the things that shall be done. And my reading of the plain language is that this court intended that there be a base rule in which a party
There's a lot of shall language in HRAP, which we extend per Rule 2. Mm-hmm. We've done it. So,
Mr. Luthringer, I'm sorry, Mr. Gluck, pardon me. I wanted you to respond to Mr. Luthringer's argument that you look at the last sentence, it says there are two explicit triggers, the filing of an order or the issuance of the clerk's notice, and that in essence is the end of the discussion. Now you say we need to look at that in context. Can you explain what exactly the context is that you're referring to?
Certainly. So I think that there's two different ways to look at the statute. Either there's a literal ruling, a literal review of the first sentence and the fourth sentence, which talk about the triggers that you mentioned. But if you take a literal view of those two sentences, then you have to ignore the second and third in their entirety. And obviously the court should not render language superfluous when it can find a reading that encompasses everything. The reading that we have suggested is that you infuse the first and fourth sentences with the second and third, such that the overall purpose of the rule is to provide a limited tolling period of up to 95 days. And in this case, you know, a party has up to 5.5 months after filing a notice of appeal, after the judgment is entered in order to file a notice of appeal. They have 10 days to file for recon, 90 for the circuit court to act, 5 for the clerk to act, another 30 to file a notice of appeal, and in some cases, another 30 days beyond that for good cause or excusable neglect. So it gets you to 165 days. And the taxpayers did not act within the 5.5 months that they had. They waited 5.5 years, and it's too long.
But go ahead.
I want to sort of talk about the shall language, you know, because shall generally is regarded as mandatory, but in certain situations, certain contexts, it may be given a directory meaning. And I'm just wondering if, you know, when a clause is deemed mandatory or directory, we have a case on it, Samante, that it depends on whether it arises from the consequences of noncompliance. So tell me about the Shaw language that we're talking about and whether the clerk's notice has legal effect.
Sure. So there's a three-prong test that this court has used to determine whether shall is merely directory or whether it's mandatory. And so I'm thinking of the Leslie case from 2006. So the first prong is, can it be read in a non-mandatory sense? Would it confute the probability of a compulsory statutory design? So in this case, I believe reading 4A3 as discretionary rather than mandatory would defeat the purpose of the rule to set a limited tolling period and require action so that appeals are decided in a timely manner. The second prong is shall not be read as mandatory when unjust consequences result. And again, I don't think that there are unjust consequences here. Parties had, again, up to 5.5 months in which to file the notice of appeal. It's very clear to all attorneys that there is a limited time for filing appeals and one should not sit and wait on that. And then third, the word shall is merely directory when no advantage is lost, no right is destroyed, no benefit is sacrificed either to the public or the individual. And in this case, you do sacrifice the benefit of finality. You do sacrifice the benefit of having appeals decided in a timely manner and complying with the court's jurisdiction.
Based on what you've just said, it appears that two of the three prongs clearly weigh in favor of the taxpayer, unjust consequences and rights lost. I mean, why should we interpret the rule the way you are indicating, which then means that a litigant, a taxpayer, loses their right to appeal?
Well, I know that taxpayers have discussed the word notice a lot, but they had notice of the beginning of the appeal deadline. They had the filing of the judgment. They knew when the judgment was filed. They knew when they filed their motions.
When was the judgment filed?
Oh. I believe July 2017.
Right. Okay.
So they knew that. They knew when they filed their own motion for reconsideration, and they should know that there is a limited time in which to file an appeal. The Coles could have filed early. They could have filed their notice of appeal the day the judgment came out. They could have filed it early, in fact, if they wanted to. They didn't. They waited 5.5 years to do so. Also, there are circumstances in which even the lack of notice is not does not kill off this idea that there's a limited time to appeal. And HRCP 77D, it talks about how entry of the judgment is going to start the clock ticking for an appeal, even if notice is not given. And
that's entry of the judgment, correct?
Yes.
Right. Because people can actually go down and see if something entered.
Yes.
And how, based on Sukuma, where we said the right to appeal is 30 days from entry of the order, and there's no order entered, how can we say that Rule 77 applies in that situation?
Well, I think because you've got a bunch of new language in the second and third sentences of 4A3 that indicates that this is supposed to be a mandatory scheme. It's supposed to set a time.
And then what happens when the court doesn't perform its mandatory duties? It's too bad for the litigants. The court doesn't do its job and it's too bad for the litigants.
Mm-hmm. And this court has applied equitable principles when parties have filed within the 60-day period, the 30 days plus the 30 days for good cause and excusable neglect. But beyond that, even if there are harsh consequences, it's still jurisdictional and the court cannot act beyond that time.
Can I ask you, Mr. Gluck, Mr. Luthringer, the same question. So in the third sentence, I guess, talks about the clerk's notice and then saying, clerk shall notify the parties, the post-judgment motion is denied, any orders entered thereafter shall be a nullity. So what is the triggering event there, the 90 days or the issuance of the notice?
The triggering event for running of the notice of appeal.
Yeah. What does the thereafter refer to? So any orders entered thereafter, is that the 90 days or any orders entered after the notice goes out?
I was reading that as after the 90th day, that any orders entered by the circuit court on day 91 or beyond would be a nullity. And I think that phrase informs the rest of the rule as well, that the circuit court is only given jurisdiction to act within that 90-day timeframe.
Okay, but then we have this following provision which talks about notice. So is there sort of an intermediate position that the court lacked the authority to do anything further after the 90 days, but there still needed to be notice before the appeal right would be triggered, or the obligation to file a notice of appeal would be triggered. That's, I characterize that as a fallback position that I thought I discerned in Mr. Luthringer's briefs. I'm pretty sure I did.
Sure. So I don't think so, because the court has only given the clerk 5 days in which to act. And the clerk can't, it doesn't have the authority to divest the circuit court of jurisdiction. The clerk has the authority only to enter a notice and only has a limited window.
I'm sorry, I really cannot hear.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. I can come much closer, Your Honor.
So sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. So the clerk has, does not have the authority to divest the circuit court judge of jurisdiction. Instead, the authority is only to provide notice, and that notice can only be provided within that 5-day window.
But isn't there a requirement? Doesn't the fourth sentence, as Mr. Luthringer suggests, indicate that it has to, one of two things has to happen. Either has to be an order, or there has to be a notice, or there's no obligation to appeal. So you have a situation where I guess the court's ultimate denial of the motion 5 years after the fact would be a nullity. But nevertheless, the obligation to appeal is not, doesn't arise until notice is given. Is that, what's your reaction to that approach?
Again, I think the taxpayer's argument is that it would revert to the circuit court judge after 90 days, but I think there's supposed to be this cutoff after 90 days. Any authority to do anything after 5 days, it's supposed to be entered within the 5 days.
So it is the city's position that the tax appeal court would be without jurisdiction to, after the 90 days, to enter an order saying, pursuant to Rule 4A3, the motion for reconsideration is deemed denied.
I think any order after the 90 days would be a nullity, Your Honor, pursuant to 4A3.
Do you think, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, so any order, I suppose perhaps if a motion for attorney's fees was on the table, the aside might be a little more active in seeking a response from the court. But, you know, on a recon motion, which are granted relatively infrequently, or a motion for a new trial for that matter, I sensed from your briefing that you thought at least there's some obligation on the part of plaintiffs to do something. I think you might have used the term sitting idly by or whatever for 5 years. How does that play into anything? I mean, I don't see an estoppel because you look at that in the case law and I don't see that. Are there equity arguments or are we just, they're out of luck?
Yeah, I think equitable principles just don't apply to the time deadlines, which are jurisdictional. And so they are out of luck if they miss the deadline on appealing.
And you mentioned that the excusable neglect provision is a possible safety valve for somebody in their situation. How would that work?
So it would still have to be within the 60 days after entry of the judgment. You have your normal 30-day period and then up to 30 days, and a party can move for an extension either before the expiration of those 30 or after the expiration of the 30 by showing excusable neglect.
So go ahead, Nona. I'm still thinking about my question. So.
It is the city's position that the rules of civil procedure and the rules of circuit court do apply unless there's a clear conflict with the...
Yes, of course.
Rule 23 allows you... 23E, if the city wants to make sure that there are deadlines set, there is nothing that prohibited the city under Rule 23E. It says if the drafting party fails to timely submit a proposed order, any other party may present an order to the court for approval and entry. So if you wanted for the appellate deadline to be triggered, and I can see why the city would want that, especially in tax appeal cases, why wouldn't you submit a draft order or submit a letter, your own letter to the clerk saying please enter your order regarding notice regarding deemed denial.
Sure. Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Justice McKenna. The city could have done so and did not do so, and I don't have an explanation as to why.
Now, you said equitable principles don't apply, but if there is some uncertainty in the rule, and I understand your position is it's crystal clear, but if we found there was some tension between those third and fourth sentences, should we interpret them in a way that preserves appellate rights? Should there be any sort of presumption or any sort of weight that we should give to a policy of preserving appellate rights when possible?
Sure, and this court has been clear that it should try to address the merits of litigants' appeals whenever possible, and that is as it should be. I think if you had a situation where the two interpretations of 4A3 were truly, those kinds of consideration could tip the scales in favor of allowing it here. But I don't think that's the case here. I think the rule is clear that it was supposed to be a limited tolling period.
But the effect of the rule amendment was very modest, so wouldn't you agree? In reference to where we were after Sukuma, under your interpretation, it kind of takes us back to, Justice Nakayama's interpretation of the rule in Sukuma, which was after 90 days, you're kind of, if there's no action, it's power and you need to appeal. Now it's 95 days and there needs to be a notice, but if that doesn't happen, you still got to appeal. Seems like it didn't, the rule amendment under your reading didn't really sort of revert it back to Sukuma, which was pre-Sukuma days, or to the dissent in Sukuma, even though another point of view carried the day in Sukuma. It seems a bit odd.
Yeah, I think I would disagree with the characterization of the amendments being modest. I think roughly half of the language in the rule has been replaced after 2016. And I think the addition of those two sentences, the use of the word shall repeatedly, the use of the word nullity to talk about the circuit court's authority, I think all of that evinces an intent to have a tolling period. Now, obviously, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage from both Your Honor, Chief Justice and Justice McKenna, in that you are on the court and may be able to speak to the intention behind the rule.
It says what it says.
It says what it says. I did also want to note, though, that we don't believe that the rule is ambiguous, even if it were, and the court were to try to look at external sources in order to evaluate the rule. I could not find anything akin to a legislative history. I had inquired with the law library. They had pointed me to, I believe, two pieces of testimony from sitting court judges, neither of which seemed relevant here. So I think the court just ends up back with the plain language again.
I mean, you have the prior language, you have Sukuma, and you have the current language.
Yes, exactly.
You're working with. Yes. Right. Anything further? I'm not trying to cut you off.
No, thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Glug. Mr. Luthringer, your rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'll keep this very brief. This question about Clause 4 and its importance and the reference to if within 90 days, if you just remove that reference from that clause, it reads the time for filing an appeal shall commence upon the filing of an order or the filing of a clerk's notice deeming the order denied. That creates a huge problem because we don't know what is what, or it's filing of this or filing of that. The reason that if 90 days language was put in there was merely to clarify that the clerk's notice will serve as the alternate trigger if the order is not filed within 90 days and the clerk's notice is. So the resolution of that if language there, simple. This idea that we keep treating the shells as may and they should be treated as shells, we do treat them as shells. The court absolutely 100% has to enter an order within 90 days. The thing is, it's a conditional limitation because if the clerk doesn't enter the notice, they retain jurisdiction. However, if the court doesn't do what they're supposed to in 90 days, the clerk can stand up, take advantage of that 5-day window, file the notice, and divest the court of its jurisdiction to act. Absent that notice, the court retains jurisdiction. As to this concept of excusable neglect potentially offering a remedy, why should the appellant have to come back and fight for their right and fight to prove that the court wasn't wrong in failing to do what they needed to do? So the excusable neglect, it's in way outfield. It doesn't apply here. And as to the overall structure of the rule, we have a default rule outlined in Clause 1. We note the default rule because the court removed the provided that language, which was a limitation on the rule, and they left it as is. Order, 30 days. Sukuma said that. It needs to be an order. The remaining three sentences, when read together, we're not going to isolate number 4. We're not going to isolate number 1. We'll read number 1 as the general default rule, and we're going to read 2, 3, and 4 as setting up either a conditional limitation or an exception. And when you read it that way, the rule makes sense. We're not in a position here where we're going, as the appellees want to suggest, an order wasn't entered, a clerk's notice wasn't entered. Well, that's a trigger for the running of the time for appeal. But the rule says you have to file an order or file a notice for the running of the appeal. So an ordinarily prudent person would never assume that by not filing an order, by not filing a clerk's notice, the time for appeal would commence. That's all I have to offer.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gluck. The court will take this matter under advisement.
A ku iluna. Please rise. Ua ho'o ku ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki ike hanohano oka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.